And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Basil Hero to the program today. Basil is a former television reporter who decided to interview as many of the surviving Apollo astronauts as possible to see if he could share how their views of life and the world were changed by going to the moon. The book is The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon, and it's available from Grand Central Publishing. So, Basil, how did the idea of talking to the remaining Apollo astronauts first come to you?
Well, my first concern was that for the historical record, that I thought it was important to hear from these men one last time. I mean, they're now approaching their 90s, some are in their 90s, and they're passing away. And I believe that they had an extra story to tell that, frankly, has not been told in any of the other books. And quite simply, it was to cover the kind of existential questions that other authors or journalists just simply were too afraid to ask about whether they believed in God and the source of courage, and essentially re-examining The Right Stuff, which Tom Wolfe had written, and to talk about the common good, believing in something greater than oneself, issues and, you know, virtues that you really don't hear much about today. They're just not in the national dialogue anymore. And so Bill Anders, who was on Apollo 8, which was the very first mission to leave Earth and go to the moon. And he, of course, took that famous photo that came to be known as Earthrise, which helped launch the environmental movement. And he had his gatekeeper, his archivist, vet me. And he wanted to know, okay, Basil, what is it that you want to write about that nobody else has written about? And when I explained what it was I was after, he said, oh, well, this is original. Yes. Actually, I would like to talk about these things because nobody's really asked me about spirituality and, you know, my, you know, sort of philosophical outlook on life and how it was altered by that voyage. And so he was very excited to talk to me, and he invited me into his home, and we had a wonderful conversation. And then he, at the end of our interview, picked up the phone and called Frank Borman, who was his crewmate on Apollo 8. And then, of course, Jim Lovell was the third crew member of that historic voyage. And we all know Jim Lovell from Apollo 13. So each of the astronauts recommended me to each other. And they really were eager to talk about these very issues.
But it was a strange thing that it was a hurricane that kind of gave your first entree into this elite group.
It is. It just happened through, you know, sheer dumb luck that my newly moved in neighbor next door was an aerospace historian and one of the foremost in the country. He also happened to be a former New York Times reporter, and he taught journalism at NYU for 30 years, Bill Burroughs. You know, the power went out and he was elderly, and I thought I must go check in on my neighbor. And of course, you know, the poor fellow just was operating on candle power at that point. And it was a substantial storm. And so
it was Hurricane Sandy, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was exactly. So I had a few spare lanterns. And when I walked into his home, I was just blown away at all the books on space. And there was one big note, you know, hanging on his corkboard, which said, "We are the space race." And I immediately recognized, you know, his name. And I said, "Are you the same Bill Burroughs who wrote this New Ocean?" He said, "Yes, I am." And so Bill was helpful in getting me to the people who were able to get me to the Apollo astronauts.
After you'd conducted all these great interviews with the Eagles, how did you go about structuring the book? What did you want to say and how to put all those interviews together?
Well, I thought what would be most interesting for readers who, A, are familiar with the story, and then those who are not, was to first get into the selection process. The reality is that when Tom Wolfe wrote The Right Stuff, he did not have access to the psychological profiles of the Eagles. Well, here we are 50 years later, and I was able to get my hands on those psychological profiles. And I thought it would be fascinating to do a deep dive into those files and to see what was it that separated them from everybody else. And to give you an analogy, they had whittled it down to 110 candidates out of 2,000. These 110, Stephen, were essentially the 110 Tom Brady's of military aviators. So imagine having 110 Tom Brady's competing for 7 astronaut slots, the Mercury 7. What separated the winners from the losers was their approach to risk. There's this misconception that they were these kinds of fearless daredevils. And the truth is, they thought that the movie, The Right Stuff, not the book, but the movie, they thought was terrible because it gave this rather Hollywoodish, inflated version of courage and bravery, kind of bordering on recklessness. These guys were far from that. These were highly educated engineers who knew the schematics and blueprints and every single bolt in the test aircraft that they were, you know, testing right off the drawing boards. And so they were perfectly aware and highly knowledgeable of what the limits of those aircraft were. And they were very careful never to push it beyond, you know, what they knew were the limits of it. And interestingly, they didn't have a lot of respect for Chuck Yeager, who has been kind of lionized as this, you know, the ultimate test pilot. They thought he was a little reckless, and recklessness, you know, to an Apollo astronaut was the kiss of death.
There's no ejector seat in space.
That's correct.
Even though we've had these high-profile, horrible disasters in the NASA's history with Apollo 1 and then the 2 space shuttles, being an astronaut was safer than being a test pilot, it seems, because it seems there was quite a few deaths in the test pilot programs.
Yes, being a test pilot at that point was a very risky business. I mean, the average was, you know, one test pilot was dying per week. You know, for the wives and for the pilots themselves, it was a very stressful, to say the least, job to have. You know, there were instances where the machines failed and it didn't matter how good a pilot you were, and instances in which maybe better piloting might have saved the pilot and his machine, but by the time they got to the Apollo programs, you know, they were able to, through simulators, and those were brand new in the early 60s, they were able to fairly well work out, you know, whatever the flaws, design flaws were in those initial supersonic aircraft.
Now, you mentioned the wives, and while the astronauts themselves had their training and their knowledge of engineering behind them and just repetitive going in the simulator day after day after day for a couple of years, and then all of the engineers and the ground crew working on the mechanics and the flight stuff, triple, quadruple, five times checking their math and such, the wives had all of the stress and none of the assurance of competency to deal with it.
They did. You know, they put the astronauts themselves into thousands of hours of simulation and training for, you know, every conceivable failure, except one, failed marriages. So, you know, the wives were given no training. They were essentially left to their own devices. NASA would assign a public affairs office to them, officer to them, but no one really prepared them psychologically for the potential trauma of death in space or, tragically, as in the case of Apollo 1, on the ground in a test. So I had interviewed the former head of the Navy SEALs who trained many of the SEALs who went in to kill Osama bin Laden, and also the flight surgeon at NASA who was there for 10 years. And independent of each other, they arrived at the same conclusion, which they said, in which they said that the wives were in many ways braver than their husbands, for the simple reason that they didn't know the potential danger day in, day out. They weren't told what the missions were. They weren't told what the risks were. So it's kind of like being hit with a tragic news of cancer or something and having no preparation for it.
Was it Bill Anders or Frank Borman that took his wife in and showed her much of the process to help allay her fears?
It was Bill Anders who took her on the factory tours. And Anders is an exceptional case. He was a real communicator. One of the chapters in the book is on the wives, and I focused on the 4 marriages that succeeded because I thought it was important, this being an inspirational book, to hear from these couples what it was that they did that the other 16 couples who did not make it, you know, what did they do right and what did they do differently? And it came down pretty much to inclusion and communication. The men were very good about keeping their wives fully informed about the missions, the risks, So they were essentially filling in for what the NASA psychiatrists should have been doing.
It was a strange contrast of way so many of these men were raised, because so many of them came from ideal homes where they had both parents and they were successful marriages,
yes,
only to watch their marriages go by the wayside.
Yes. And really, in fairness to the men and to the wives, it was through no fault of their own. The reality of the moonshot was that the deadline, the timeline that Kennedy had placed on NASA for the landing was such that it required that these men were working 16-hour days, and as they were getting closer to their missions, 7 days a week. So they were barely seeing their families on the weekends. So it would have taken an exceptional marriage and an exceptional wife, actually, to put up with that and be understanding. But there was the case of the four who really were prepared to sacrifice without resentment, you know, for their husbands' careers.
And also, what makes a good astronaut? Being calm under pressure does not necessarily make for a good husband who does not communicate when he's under pressure.
That's exactly right. So that, you know, what works in space to keep your cool and to lead with your head and not with your heart doesn't work particularly well at home. And of course, the most famous example of that was Neil Armstrong, who had lost a daughter at the age of two. And
she had a brain tumor, is that right?
I believe so. And so his wife never really could get over it. And Armstrong, being, you know, the practical engineer that he was, you know, assessed the situation and said, well, we have to move on. You know, we can't keep living in the past. And you can see each other's, you know, point of view. But there, in a nutshell, you see the conundrum that faced the wives.
A few of the Eagles went on into the business world and were very successful. What lessons do you think they learned while in the Apollo program that they were able to take over to the private sector?
I would say that the key lesson was the benefits of having what we now refer to as a flat organization, in which you have as few layers of management as possible. So that particularly if you are in the high-tech world or the engineering world, it's absolutely vital that the engineers who are on the front line building whatever the system is are able to report up the line very quickly if they're spotting errors, because you're talking about matters of life and death. And so the one statistic that really informed every decision that occurred at NASA during those years was what they call the triple nines, the 99.9% reliability rate, which the engineers strove for. But if you do the math, on a spacecraft, including the Apollo, the Saturn V rocket had 5.6 million parts. Well, 0.1% failure rate means you're going to have 5,600 things that could go wrong. And so they built redundancies into the system. So they learned, A, how to communicate, admit mistakes in real time. Wernher von Braun, who built the Saturn V, had a management tool that he called the Monday Notes, in which he wanted to hear from the lowest level engineer about any problems that were, you know, surfacing. Because if he didn't catch it early, you could have rockets blowing up on the pad, men dying. And, you know, a contemporary example of this is look at Boeing and the 737. There's no way that there are not memos somewhere inside Boeing in which engineers at the lower level were not warning their superiors that there were software problems with that computer. They never would have allowed that to have happened in the Apollo era. It did happen briefly with Apollo 1, but then they took a 22-month hiatus, almost 2 years before they flew another spacecraft, to make sure that they had corrected the problem. They would argue for A, have a clear vision, have a clear deadline, hire the very best people that you can, delegate down, and as Warren Buffett has famously said, delegate almost to the point of abdication. And of course, they believed in young people, so that the average age of the flight controller in mission control was 26 years old.
It's almost like the tech startups now. They work the young people so hard.
Bingo. There you have it. And they were eager to work hard, and they were trainable and not fixed in their ways, which is important.
Did you learn and start to grok a lot about technology and the technological process in the research for this book?
Frankly, I was awed by it, because when you begin to fully grasp the scale and the complexity of it all, I mean, to think that in 1961, when Kennedy announced that we would go to the moon, we had no idea how to do it. We didn't have the rockets. We didn't have the spacecraft. We didn't have the management systems, the management technology, nothing. And to do that in 7 years, to have 400,000 engineers scattered across the country with 40,000 contractors, that is an enormous management task that has to be solved. And they did it. It's incredible to think that we were actually driving solar-powered cars on the moon 50 years ago, and today we don't have a rocket that can even get us into space with the payload that, you know, made it to the moon.
It has also struck me that of the disasters that we've had in the NASA program, that they've all been within the Earth's atmosphere, that we've never lost a person in orbit or toward the moon.
That's right. That's exactly right. You know, the most dangerous time in any space voyage is the launch itself and then the reentry.
Of the astronauts who actually made it to the moon, there's a few that had to stay behind in the command module,
yes.
And a couple would go down to the surface of the moon. Did they have different perspectives than the men that had actually walked on the moon?
Interestingly, they did. They were often a bit more philosophical because they had more time to reflect. So here they are, they're by themselves, you know, alone in the command module, while their two crewmates are down on the surface. And what was particularly interesting for them was when they were on the backside of the moon, because there you lost communication with NASA. There was no way you could get a signal from the backside of the moon. In some instances, depending on, you know, the alignment of the stars and the sun, you could see, you know, from the backside of the moon out into the vastness of the universe. And it was awe-inspiring for a number of them. And it really sort of altered their perception of God, of humanity, of Earth's place in the universe. When they all returned, it didn't matter whether they were orbiting or walking on the moon, the conclusion that they came to was that we are living in the Garden of Eden, and we have failed to appreciate it. So, you know, the moon is just dead. As Bill Anders said, it's just battlefield ugly. It has a kind of a haunting majesty to it, but really there isn't a shred of greenery. You can't breathe there. It's a dead place, and the Earth is the only known planet in our solar system that has water and the kind of life forms and greenery that we so take for granted.
The moon has no weather or tide to smooth over those impacts from the asteroids and such.
Exactly, exactly.
So it wears its scars openly.
It sure does.
You mentioned views on God and metaphysics and such. It seems there's quite a varied approach of the Eagles. There's no consistent theme in their approach toward religion and metaphysics.
That's exactly right. There were two people in particular who were very fascinating. One was Jim Lovell from Apollo 13. And Lovell made a statement to me, this was a year and a half ago, in which he said, you know, Basil, after 50 years, I've concluded that you don't go to heaven when you die, you go to heaven when you were born. Well, I have to tell you, Steve, I just about fell out of my chair when I heard that. I mean, it was just the most extraordinary statement. And if you're a very religious person, you know, that kind of knocks you upside the head. And so I called up the dean of the Yale Divinity School and Harvard, and I said, gentlemen, have you ever heard such a formulation before? In the 2,000 years of Christianity, has any great philosopher or thinker said anything like this? And they said, no, this is a first, because it's a complete inversion of the ascension narrative. It shocked them, and they admitted that it was purely the result of their having seen Earth from deep space and the moon, and this idea that we are living in the Garden of Eden. And therefore, according to Lovell, man, you're already in paradise. Every day, every morning that you wake up, appreciate that flower out there or that park or the trees. This is as good as it's going to get because there's no other place in the universe that's like it. And interestingly, as a result of the Apollo missions, what has happened in the theology schools is that they now teach a new course called eco-theology. And the argument goes like this. If the Earth is God's creation, then we have an obligation to care for God's Earth. You know, interestingly, the biggest proponent of this has been the Pope, who has been an enormously vocal activist, you know, on behalf of climate change. So there's another example of how God and theology and the whole conception of God's role in the universe was altered by the lunar missions. You had Jim Irwin, who walked on the moon, who said that Jesus talked to him there. Conversely, you had Bill Anders from Apollo 8 come back. He was a practicing Catholic. He came back 3 days later and he says, "This is all bunk. You know, after looking at the billions of galaxies out there, I came to the conclusion that, you know, we're just this tiny, insignificant little planet. And this notion that God sits up there with some supercomputer, you know, overlooking all of it is just sheer nonsense." Then you had Mike Collins, who was on Apollo 11 with Armstrong and Aldrin. He says, "I'm not an atheist," he said, "but I can tell you that I also disagree with some of the more religious fanatics who have this kind of ludicrous certainty that creation took place in 7 days and et cetera, et cetera." And he didn't believe in that either. And he concluded, he said to me, he says, I find God more in the coral reef than I do in the cathedral. And the question, of course, that he asks, it's the question he used to ask as a kid, well, you know, who created God and who created the creator that created God? And his final question was, what was there before the Big Bang? Who created that? So these are the kinds of brain teasers, you know, that they addressed and which are absolutely fascinating to hear from the only 24 human beings who have ever left Earth's orbit to go visit another heavenly body.
And so while Borman and Anders had these very successful business careers, Alan Bean goes the opposite direction, embraces art to work through his experience there on the moon.
Yes, he was actually a lay minister, and he concluded that there is no benevolent God. And he came around to that conclusion because he thought, well, if there's a God the Father, and a father is supposed to take care of you, then how does that account for the kids in the cancer wards and what have you? He came back, amazingly said, you know, I've never complained about the weather again. I'm glad there's weather. He went down to a shopping mall, bought himself an ice cream cone, and just sat there and started watching people. He found a newfound appreciation for the earth and life here, and he devoted himself to painting, and painting only the moon missions and his walk on the moon with Pete Conrad. An extraordinary man. And he also said something which I think would be sort of jolting to today's elected officials. He said that all of those congressmen and senators who wear the American flag on their lapels should rip it off because he found them to be false patriots and self-serving jackasses. He said they should be either wearing lapel pins that are of the Republican Party, Democratic Party, or, as he said, their own damn picture. So he had no patience for today's politicians who pretend to be patriotic, but if it comes time for them to go off to the war, you know, they're claiming they've got, you know, bone spurs or bunions or whatever it is. So he was unsparing in his criticism of today's elected politicians, as was, frankly, Mike Collins, who thinks that one of America's greatest cultural failings is the celebration of celebrity, being famous just for being famous. These guys had no patience for people who brag, who are spiking footballs in the end zone. They believe in quiet patriotism and keeping your ego in check.
On the first moon landing and moonwalk,
yes,
we have two men who are very different in their approach to mm-hmm. their post-Apollo lives. You have Neil Armstrong, who never wanted celebrity, said he couldn't take credit for 48,000 other people's work. And you have Buzz Aldrin, who really enjoys being in the limelight.
He does. And if you talk to the rest of the Apollo astronauts, they don't like Buzz for that particular reason. They respect him for his contribution to the mechanics of orbital rendezvous and docking, because without him, and let's not forget, you know, Aldrin got his PhD at MIT. He's just not a, I mean, he was a brilliant man, but he unfortunately chased celebrity and fame much to their distaste.
He is famously pugnacious when it comes to conspiracy theorists saying that we never went to the moon. Did that topic ever come up with any of the Eagles that you interviewed?
No. And when I met with them, it just didn't even cross my mind to bring it up because it's just so silly. I mean, clearly we landed on the moon, and these conspiracy theorists, it's just all nonsense. So no, it did not come up. We did talk about, you know, is there life on other planets? They're all convinced that there is, that the statistical probability is such that there would be. So they're consistent on certain matters and not on others, but generally there's a lot of agreement on many points. I think here's one important thing to add. The three words that I heard consistently from them were duty, honor, country. And I would add a fourth thing to that, the common good. And they all love the United States. They love their country. I think the interesting thing that happened when they returned was that duty, honor, country suddenly became duty, honor, planet, Earth. Because from deep space, they don't see borders, they don't see nations, they don't see races, and their hope for the planet and for humanity is that we all see ourselves collectively as a single planetary species and not Indian, African, Russian, you see. And that has been their hope, and it has remained so for 50 years.
Did they seem particularly distressed about the recent trend toward nationalism around the world?
Yes, they're horrified by it. We've actually gone backwards and not forwards, and it's a shocking development to them. And Mike Collins tells the fascinating story of how upon their return, they went on a world tour. And no matter which continent they were in, Africa, Asia, South America, the word, the pronoun that they kept hearing over and over again was we. We did it. The people weren't saying to them, you did it, you Americans did it. It was we the world, we humanity did it. And Collins was really kind of blown away by that. You know, there was that brief moment in time when the whole world watched that night as Armstrong took his first steps, and it was this kind of collective moment of awe that it was a planetary accomplishment as opposed to an American accomplishment. And I think the reason for that is because America, and if we're going to talk about American exceptionalism, what makes this country, I believe, unique is the fact that we have represented here virtually every country in the world. We have some group of those members of those countries. So we are kind of the leading edge towards a planetary species, I think.
Let's get to something a little bit more fun. How's your book tour been going?
The book tour has been sensational. I have to say, I welcome and cherish every opportunity I get to talk about these men and the virtues of the common good and duty, honor, country, and believing in something greater than oneself. Because I think it's important for young people to be made aware of this and these values. And these are timeless values. You know, Aristotle and Plato were talking about them 2,000-3,000 years ago, and they've not really changed. You know, moral courage and the common good. I believe that it's more important than ever today because we have, I believe, become a slightly Darwinian culture. You know, kind of the survival of the fittest, winner take all. And I don't think that's the kind of mentality that gets you back to the moon again or anywhere else for that matter or accomplishing any singularly great endeavor. I think that we have to think of ourselves as citizens and not consumers. So I'm prepared to preach this gospel for as long as I've got breath in my body. because I think it needs to be reintroduced into the body politic.
Well, with a name like the Basil Hero, you're well suited.
Well, thank you.
So your name is just quite remarkable. Could you talk about your family history and how y'all became heroes?
Well, my mother was actually born in Athens right before the start of the Second World War, and Germans had actually occupied her house. She received a scholarship at the end of the war to come study in the United States, and she came over, and my father had just gotten out of the Army. He was a surgeon. He served with General Patton's Third Army in Europe, and the general decorated him with a Bronze Star for operating for nearly 4 days straight during the Battle of the Bulge. They got married. His parents were Greek immigrants. He was born in New York City, so the name actually is of Greek origin. And they named me Basil because they met at St. Basil's Academy, which was a orphanage run by the church.
And so how's that name treated you over the years?
Well, it's funny that you should ask, because when I came to Memphis to work for Channel 5 back in 1981, there was a wonderful news director then. His name was Frank Gardner. He eventually became the president of Scripps Howard. And he says, we're going to have to change your name. So I looked at him, and I knew I wasn't going to change my name. I said, which half do you object to? Is it Basil or is it Hero? Because they're both weird. And he said, trust me, he says, we're going to have to change the last name Hero, he says, because I know this audience down here, and they're going to be falling off their bar stools when they hear your last name. So anyway, I stuck to my guns, and it's actually wound up serving me quite well because it's not an easy name to forget.
Have you found another topic that you might think is worthy of a book investigation for?
I have, actually, and I'm already working on it. And it has to do essentially with living up to the expectations of one's parents. And, you know, what's been in the news recently, of course, is parents, buying their kids' way, into college. And it puts pressure on the kids. And for the last few years, I was actually running a mental health agency, and we were servicing middle and high school students and trying to help them with their anxiety and depression and the suicide rates, which have really been going up all over the country. This is a new phenomenon in the last 10 years. It's accelerating. It's getting worse. And so I want to write about that and try to create a text that both students and their parents can follow to not put the kind of pressure that they're putting on each other and to, much like the Eagles, allow one's children to find their strength and to follow their passion, or as Joseph Campbell, the famous mythologist, said, to follow your bliss. And if you pursue your passion, you will eventually make a living. The object isn't to chase the almighty dollar, but to chase a goal which ultimately leaves you feeling better about yourself and leaving the earth and the world a better place than you found it.
Did you take Campbell's The Hero's Journey to heart?
I did, very much so. He's one of my heroes, the hero of 1,000 faces. And of course, he wrote with Bill Moyers, from PBS, The Power of Myth, which is a wonderful series. And any listeners out there who should just Google it and listen to it, because it's powerful.
Well, Basil, thank you so much for coming back to Memphis and sharing the mission of a lifetime with us.
Thank you for allowing me to tell my story.
Basil Heroes, the author of The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. And it's available from Grand Central Publishing. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.